I would like to share with you a poem by my favorite poet, David White. It's called The Well of Grief. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface of the well of grief, turning downward to its black water, to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink, the secret water, cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. 2 years ago, in the fall of 2005, my dear friend Jackie was diagnosed with an inoperable brain aneurysm. And she was told that if it continued to grow at the rate it had been growing, that she would not live beyond New Year's. There was virtually no hope of survival. There was nothing she could do. She would simply get a fierce headache and die within about 15 minutes. Oh, and she would bleed profusely, so you might want to carry towels with you, dark ones. Wow. You know, how does one take in that kind of information? And what point of view do I hold? What's even my role here? Am I to be the hopeful, optimistic cheerleader for my friend? Am I to be her chaplain? Am I to take the opportunity to eulogize her face to face while there's still time left, not wanting to leave anything left unsaid? Is feeling any of my own fear or pain of anticipated loss or grief hopelessly selfish and unsupportive? Every moment that I spend consternating about any of this, I'm missing the preciousness of each moment ticking away. And yet how does one possibly stay present and be in the moment when absorbing information like this? I'm a hospital chaplain, as you know, and I work primarily with end-stage cancer patients. And I heard myself in my own inner dialogue sounding exactly like virtually every family member of every patient that I see. Well, my girl's different, you're going to see. She's tough. We're going to have a miracle. She's such a good person, and she's been through so much already. God didn't bring her this far just to drop her. And then I caught myself in my chaplain mirror, and I heard the sweet, childlike, naive, magical thinking and theology, really, that I don't really believe that's reflected in such statements. But more importantly, I could hear the deep love in a whole new way in which such statements are rooted. Truth is, I was just stuck. What can you do? Just breathe, right? So on November 2nd of that year, Jackie and I were driving down the Santa Ana Freeway, somewhere near the glamorous Commerce Casino, on our way to a concert in Orange County. Permit me this digression, if you will. I know Commerce, I thought he was talking about the Holy Land. What's this about Commerce? We'll get there. I may not get there with you, but we'll get there. So why wasn't I going to the concert with my partner, Scott? Well, because on September 27th that fall, Scott had a terrible accident and had severely injured his left eye. He was home face down, immobile for weeks, recovering from his second of four surgeries so far to repair his eye. I bring this up only to put into a kind of context how notions about loss and comparative loss and the hierarchical nature of suffering, these are fun topics around our house. So there we are, Jackie and I, driving down the Santa Ana Freeway. And I do need to tell you that Jackie and I met during my first unit of internship for chaplaincy at UCLA. And chaplain humor can be, shall we say, on the dark side. So there's this billboard by the Commerce Casino promoting tourism to Alaska. And it's the image of a license plate frame. And it says on it, "Before you die." So I said to Jackie, "See there, Jackie, you can't die yet. Don't you need to go to Alaska first?" And she laughed, and she told me about all these inadvertently morbid messages she had been receiving from the universe. She'd gotten her New Yorker magazine subscription renewal notice, and it said in big, bold type, "Jackie Gorman, your time is running out." But then she did tell me that when she had been to Jerusalem 12 years earlier, that she had promised herself she would go back before she died. "Well, then you got to go back," I said. "You just got to go back. If they've given you no hope whatsoever, then keeping a promise like that to yourself would just have to be the most life-affirming thing you could do. You've just got to go." "I can't go alone," she said. "Will you go with me?" "Well, shit." "Okay. Yes, I will." So on December 14th, 2005, which would have been my grandmother's 100th birthday, and believe me, when there's nothing else to hold on to, I'll take any omen I can get. Turns out Jackie's daughter, her 19-year-old daughter, wanted to go with us. So the three of us on December 14th, we left for Jerusalem a mere 2 weeks before New Year's. But boy, planning for such a trip. I had Jackie's durable power of attorney for health care, so I had my packet of papers and contact numbers and instructions. Jackie had given me explicit instructions that if I die, just leave my body, I don't care, I'll be in Jerusalem, just get Kelsey home as quickly as possible. Those were my orders. Well, that sounds simple enough, but it's a body. It's not exactly like, oops, I left my toothbrush in the hotel room, you know what I mean? Again, with the chaplain humor. Jackie, if you do die, do you suppose we'll have to pay extra baggage on your body since we would have purchased the seat anyway? And I swear, girl, if your body gets stuck in that luggage carousel at LAX coming back, I'm going to be so embarrassed. But the truth is, I had to find very serious answers to serious questions. What would I do if she died? Jews don't cremate, you know. How possible would it be to bury a non-Israeli in Israel? How would I get her body back? I did some research, talked to Israeli friends. Turns out getting a non-Israeli buried in Israel would be quite a Herculean task. It was surreal. I was planning for death and vacation at the same time. How on earth do you pack for that? Oh, and just to up the ante a little bit, a reference to the aforementioned Commerce Casino, Jackie started having seizures before we left, bad ones. And now, the more complicating scenario might not be that she dies. What happens if she needs to be hospitalized indefinitely? What then? I asked her, I said, is there anything at all that would make you reconsider making this trip? Nothing at all, she said, I'm going. That's my girl, so I'm in too. Off we went. The Holy Land. It's not a term I would have ever used, and I never thought about the trip in those terms. Historical, yes, but holy, that's just kind of not my deal. And it wasn't until we got back, I called Jackie, got her answering machine, and she said, we've returned from the Holy Land, safe and sound. And I thought, oh yeah, that's what it's called. I was there. And I thought about it some more, and I thought, what makes it holy in a metaphorical way? And I knew I had been on some kind of journey to some place I'd call sacred ground, but I also knew it had nothing to do with real estate. So what is that journey? That's the journey I'd like to try to define and describe, if only for myself, through a few observations and anecdotes. Meir is an Israeli real estate developer here in Los Angeles. He's a holdover client of mine from my previous career as a designer. He had been building a huge condo complex in Hollywood and been consulting with me all along the process. He called me just before I was getting ready to go and was desperate to have a meeting. I said, Meir, I don't have any time. He was insistent, and so I gave him an hour. I told him I was going to be visiting his homeland and the circumstances under which I was going. And he very kind of glibly said, oh, Michael, your friend will be fine. You'll see. Sometimes the confidence of other people. Sometimes it can feel supportive and sometimes it can just piss you off because it just feels so dismissive. At the end of our meeting, he opened up his wallet. He pulled out a $100 bill. I said, what, Meir, are you going to give me some spending money? He says, no, Michael, you know what a mitzvah is? I said, of course, Meir, it's a good deed. He said, will you take this money and you divide it up any way you see fit and you go to the Western Wall and there will be poor people there begging and you give this money away and you will be what we call the mitzvah messenger. And we have a belief that the mitzvah messenger is always protected. It was so sweet. And just the vote of confidence I needed, because I got to tell you, I was feeling pretty darn scared. My partner, Scott, had arranged for a wonderful trip for us. He arranged for the hotel. He arranged for a guide and driver for us for four of the days we were there. Moisha. Moisha, soon enough, drove us absolutely nuts. And we did not know what to do about it. We were too polite to fire him. We thought maybe he'll be better tomorrow. Maybe we'll get somebody worse. He's a sweet, sweet guy, and he's knowledgeable as all get out, and has a fascinating background. He grew up on this progressive kibbutz, but then he became an Orthodox rabbi. He's still in the Secret Service. He carries a gun. What's that about? And then we found out he had adopted an adult child with disabilities, so we thought, oh, brother, now we really can't fire him. But he would not shut up. We could never just be in a place and allow ourselves to experience it and allow our imaginations to soar. No, we had to hear about it. We had to hear everything about it. Micah, you see this rock over here? This very stone is very, 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 very important to the Muslim people. You see this crack right here in this stone? No, Michael, over here. This stone right here. And it was like that for 8 hours a day. everything was this teacherly rhetorical question. Here we have the new gate. Why do we call it the new gate? I tell you why, because it's new. But we talk more about that later. I'm not making this up. I have the video to prove it. So when we did finally get to the Western Wall, it was pouring rain. There were no poor people about. There were plenty of what appeared to be prosperous enough looking Hasidic men with their fur-trimmed hats encased in plastic wrap, but none of them approached me. A few approached Moshe with their hand up, but none would even look at me. So I told Moshe about my mitzvah to deliver. Not a problem, Michael. He works with a rabbi who feeds homeless families, of course. And so he said, you give the money to me, I'll give it to the rabbi, he'll feed the families, and your mitzvah will be delivered. I said, great, but now I need to get to an ATM to get some cash. They weren't so plentiful. So he drives us to an ATM, I get the money, and he says, I'd like a business card to put in the envelope with the money so the rabbi will know who to thank. Oh, and Michael, I'd like one too. Well, now I've got a dilemma, because I've got three business cards to choose from. I've got Michael Esselin Design, I've got Michael Esselin Chaplain, UCLA Medical Center, and Michael Esselin Gays and Lesbians Initiating Dialogue for Equality. I had never come out to Moshe. I just didn't quite know how that would land. I didn't want it to get in the way of our trip. Yes, he had grown up in a progressive kibbutz, but he'd also been an Orthodox rabbi. For appearance's sake, I look like Jackie's boyfriend traveling with her daughter. We did nothing to illuminate him, and God knows he didn't ask. He had teaching to do. But this was the end of our third day, and I was just about up to here with religion and religiosity, and I thought, damn it, I want that rabbi to know it's a gay man who's giving him this money. So I gave Moshe the glide cards. He didn't look at him, he slips them in his wallet. The next day, it's our last day with Moshe. His whole energy is different. He's letting his hair down. He's smoking in front of us. The Americans, I know they hate the smoking, but I figure, what? It's our last day. You're not going to fire me anyway, so I smoke. So we're leaving the old city through the dung gate. Why we call it the dung gate? And he starts getting very quiet. And he finally says, Michael, last night, I take out your card and I'm looking at it and I'm reading it and I'm studying it and I look and I see this gays and lesbians and issue. What is that, Michael? And so I came out to him and I told him about Glide and the wonderful work we do combating homophobia. It was such a relief just to be able to talk for the first time in 4 days. You have no idea. And he was very quiet. And then he said, I see. Remember, Michael, I tell you I have a 29-year-old son in Tel Aviv? He is a gay. And I'm not happy about it. I never talk to anybody about it, ever. I talk to you about it. And for the next 2 hours or so, we had something akin to what I would call a Holy Land kind of experience. That serendipitous kind of sharing and openness and vulnerability. And it made me wonder what the real mitzvah was. Was it Meir giving me the vote of confidence to get on the plane to be the mitzvah messenger? Was it really giving the money to the rabbi just to feed some poor folks? Or was it ultimately to have Moshe have the opportunity to come out of his painful closet at last to someone, or me to him, or was it all of it? Is maybe the Holy Land not getting what we're looking for and finding something else? Those coins at the bottom of the well of grief that David White talks about? I will tell you one thing that I have learned, that ownership, and everything it implies gets in the way of any kind of experience of Holy Land. I imagine most of us have had the experience of thinking we knew about a place because we'd seen images of it forever on TV, or we studied it, and then we finally go visit it, and we say, oh, so that's what New York City's like, as if we can ever know a place. Going to Jerusalem, to the real estate, was like that for me. It was this amazing collision of cultures and histories and civilizations and belief systems and mythologies all heaped on so little land like some colossal game of musical chairs. And for me, there was this palpable sense of me, no me, mine, I was here first, I got dibs, ownership, holding on. And it was as if the building, the rock, the artifact, the thing meant infinitely more than the message or the meaning in the history, in the story, in the myth. Even Moshe had to agree with me. Michael, the only way for Jerusalem to ever work is for everyone to realize it's an international city. It belongs to no one. It belongs to God. But sadly, that's never going to happen. And that is a tragedy. I was raised a Catholic, and so my initiation into faith was shot through that lens of Catholicism, even though I don't remotely identify as Catholic or even as Christian today. And even so, I could not be helped but filled with awe and reverence for these holy sites, whether they were Christian, Muslim, or Jewish, just for the sheer weight of humanity and intention invested in them. It's overwhelming. And it didn't even matter to me if they were even the real deal at all. You know, Helena, who was Constantine's mother in the year 327, made a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And what do you know? She found the cross. She's the one who identified the Rock of Calvary where Jesus was crucified. She identified the Via Dolorosa, the stations of the cross. She found and decided where all these sites were that Christians have been revering ever since, 300 years after Jesus walked. Talk about chutzpah. And to me, I say, so what? These are still the sites that nearly 2,000 years of humanity have invested and have said are the sites, and it moves me whether Jesus was really laid out on this rock, no Michael, this rock over here, or not. Irony abounds, and it is layered and layered upon itself. It's so thick you can't even tease it apart. Having been raised a Catholic, I was also raised to believe that the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church, was the original Christian Church and everything else was some kind of offshoot. And I have visited enough European cathedrals that have been designed specifically with the intention of drilling home that notion. And it wasn't until I got to the origin, to here in Jerusalem, where I could really see the messiness of early Christianity that exists today. Ownership. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the holiest site in Christendom, the site of the crucifixion and the tomb of Jesus, it is held under lock and key, owned, if you will, by the same Muslim family that has held the key since the Middle Ages. Every morning they make a big show about unlocking the door. Inside it is a veritable carnival of chapels, each one owned by a different denomination. The Rock of Calvary is controlled, owned by the Greek Orthodox. The Catholics have the tomb of Jesus. The Armenians have this spot. The Coptics have this spot. Inside there is this amazing cavernous space that is in complete rubble and disrepair. Moshe says it will never be repaired because no one can agree upon who owns it. That afternoon, we would have to leave Moshe in order to go visit Bethlehem, which sits in Palestinian-held territory. Moshe's not allowed to travel there. So off we go through this impossibly high concrete wall crowned with barbed wire, through this incredibly high-tech checkpoint Charlie-ish kind of border crossing, to be greeted on the other side by Edward, our Christian Palestinian guide, who would drive us the rest of the way into Bethlehem, and more importantly to Edward, to his shop that sells enough carved olive wood nativity scenes to circle the globe twice. And we finally get to Bethlehem, to the Church of the Nativity. This is the spot where it all happened. How can you not be moved by that? And this, again, is not some grand European cathedral. This looks like some tacky little shrine that looks much more like one of the fortune teller parlors in the Pike in Long Beach, where I grew up, than it resembles Notre Dame. There's this little tacky table with a little tablecloth on it with fringe and little candles, and you get on your hands and knees, you crawl under the table, and you reach your hand down a hole in the ground, and there it is. You touch a greasy rock down there. And that's the spot. And again, it doesn't matter to me one bit if it's the spot or not the spot. This is the spot that 2,000 years of humanity has set at the spot. And just to hold your hand on the greasy rock and contemplate what has been begotten from that rock. The civilizations built and destroyed, the wars fought, the millions of lives lost, the millions of lives given, lifted up in hope, the amazing art, architecture, music created, the lives of patients today at UCLA on the 10th floor who are intimately connected in their prayers and invested with what happened on this rock. It is overwhelming. And to think about what I had to go through to get to this rock, that I had to leave Moshe behind, that I had to go through that border crossing to get to this spot that is really at its core only about peace, love, and forgiveness, the core of virtually every religious tradition. You could be crushed under the irony of that alone. And to think that tomorrow I will get on a plane with the memory of this place seared in my brain, and when I step off the plane at the Delta terminal at JFK, the first thing I'm going to see is this enormous helium-inflated snowman sitting atop a Starbucks while Johnny Mathis is crooning White Christmas over the PA system. Written by a Jew, All of that, too, was begotten from the greasy rock I had my hand on yesterday. It is too much. And yet it is moving. It is moving to think how little we have learned about how to love, how to forgive, how to make peace. And yet we still have not blown up the world. We still show up for ourselves, for our lives, for our loved ones. We still have hope for our friends in hopeless situations, even while we're terrified of having to say goodbye. And I knew I had been on some kind of journey to the Holy Land, but not in any way that a religious pilgrim would mean. There was that deeply personal inward journey through my own hopes and fears and what do I really believe anyway. And there is this outward journey, a manifestation of that same journey, only it's multiplied by the billions and it's magnified across the millennia. And in a very grand and messy way, it's called Jerusalem. That whole notion of ownership, of holding on, I had to look at that in the most deeply personal and profound way in the degree that I was holding on to Jackie, to her physical presence. When the thing that it's the most human drive of all, and yet the thing I value most is the love, is the relationship, is the spirit. And I saw that I had to be willing to let go of that physical that was so completely out of my control if I was still going to have the thing that I valued most. If I hold on too tight, I'm going to miss it. One of my favorite quotes is by Richard Rohr, who said that emptiness has to precede fullness. Spirituality is always about letting go, always. And I think, yes, that's true. But then I think, isn't there something sacred in holding on to? Isn't there life force in that? Isn't that the thing that keeps us plugging along? Holding on is what got me on the plane to Israel. But in a way, so was letting go. And so now I wonder if the holiest of holy places is the place in between holding on and letting go. In that place, can we maybe move into a deeper sense of communion, a deeper sense of meaning? Maybe there can we discover riches that we didn't even know we were looking for. Is that where we can find those coins that David White talks about people who are wishing for something else? The Holy Land is having Jackie alive today, October 28th, 2 years later. Her aneurysm inexplicably stopped growing, for now. When I got that news about a year ago last spring, it was not the jump up and down moment you might expect of excitement. It was just as surreal trying to take in that information and incorporate it into reality as I'd come to understand it as it was to absorb the bad news the previous fall. Jackie responded the same way. She said, "You know, I never thought I could attach myself to that bad news so completely, and I guess I can't afford to attach myself to this news either. It's that place in between." I'd like to think that Jackie can dare to hope for and expect a future because she kept that promise to herself. Or it's because we spent the most divine 45 minutes floating effortlessly on the Dead Sea under the most impossibly beautiful sky and far away from Moshe's voice. Some people would say prayers were answered or that positive healing energy in the universe healed Jackie. Perhaps the aneurysm has simply found the place between holding on and letting go. And so it is. Thank you.
Do you have any kind of general feedback for people who have to make that in-between decision you're so well spoke of regarding your own friends?
Wow, that's a big question. I could do an hour or two on that alone. I don't even use the term spiritual counselor because it implies I've got something to tell them, and I don't. I'm not the one in the bed facing this. My role is to be someone who walks alongside them, to create the space where they can tell me their truth and not be judged for it, whatever it is. I'm sick of living, or I'm angry as hell, I was cut too short, or I'm sick that my son is going to be taken away from me. And to no need to put a positive spin on it. It's to be there and to receive it. And to the degree that if there are And that sounds like a small thing. That is not a small thing. It's a huge thing. It's a huge thing to give somebody. As you, any of you know who has ever suffered and had anybody, even if you're depressed and somebody pipes up, what do you got to be depressed about? Or be happy. Or just go be positive. And just, I just want to slug somebody in the face when they tell me that. It's the person who says, tell me more. You know, how does it hurt? Just let it come out is a huge gift, and it's not easy to do to receive it. That's one thing. Anybody who's caring for a caregiver is to offer that grace for that person to be however they are. And it's very hard when it's your loved one and they're pissing you off because they're not being cooperative and they're not doing it the way you would. And then there's this lingering thing of, would you just die or live already? I can't stand this limbo thing. And then you judge yourself like crazy for wishing that. And to the degree that you can offer that grace to your loved one to be however they are, with no need to move them in any direction, to somehow be able to offer that to yourself too. And to just say, we are on this path together, and there is love. And love is sometimes going to look like an argument, and it's sometimes going to look like crawling in bed together and just holding each other and being quiet. It's all love. I don't know how much more advice to give other than that. To the degree that someone is blaming themselves or feeling like, I had a woman once 70 years old who I saw for the first time, and I just said, tell me about your life. And she said, my life has been a colossal waste of time. Now that's a tragedy. And I just asked her, why would you say that? And she went on and on. Now I could have been all hopeful and tried to reframe it for her in a positive way. The truth is, she's at the end of her life and there's no time to do it over, and she feels like it's been a waste of time. It is painful to sit in the room and just let that be true. But it is also a gift, and there's something healing about it. And so when somebody's facing death, your dad might be doing that, I'm alive and I'm not going to let this disease get me down. And there may come one moment like that, or there may not, when he's going to say, I don't think my mother ever loved me. And to be able to be there and say, oh, tell me more. And say, oh, of course he did. Blah, 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 blah. Grandma loved you. But, you know, all of that stuff. The truth is going to come out when you least expect it. Sometimes with patients, for me, particularly younger patients, I have a lot of patients in their 20s that don't make it. And I play cards with them. I mean, because you're not going to sit down with a 20-year-old and say, so tell me, what do you think about God, the universe, the big questions of life? You know, what are you talking about? You know, and then so I say, you, just to pass the time, because they're in the hospital for weeks and weeks suffering like crazy. And if they're well enough, we play gin. And as we're playing gin and cursing at the cards, then, did I tell you about this? You know, then it comes out. Those are the kinds of things that anybody can do. I don't mean to give a whole primer on how to be a caregiver, but I mean, that's just some of my own input.
What precipitated your career change? And how do you nurture yourself?
Wow, there's another hour talk. What precipitated the career change? And this is interesting, and I wanted to share with the young man who is having the anxiety crisis about work and everything. And my heart is so open to you. I'm going to give another sermon. There's no way to do this. 1991, there was the last big recession in Los Angeles. Real estate prices went down like crazy. I was in the design and architecture business. I had no work. I thought I was the loser of the world. How am I going to make a living? I'm not a man anymore. All of that stuff. God didn't give me all the parts I need. I'm just going to take my ball and go home or something like that. It was a very, very painful time. It was also a time when so many gay men were dying of AIDS. I volunteered to go deliver Project Angel Food, which is a group in L.A. that took they still do home-cooked meals to folks dying of AIDS. It was a much smaller homegrown operation. Every day they'd put out the meals, and we'd say a prayer around the meals if you wanted to, and just bless the food, and they'd read the names of the guys who had died that day, of our clients, because there's always a dozen of them. One day a nurse comes into the circle and says, I believe no one should have to die alone. I'm starting a new project calling Project Nightlight. We're looking for volunteers to go be with our clients who are very close to death around the clock in 2-hour shifts. So if you're willing to go be, sit with somebody for 2 hours at 2 a.m. or something, sign up. And I just had this kick in my gut, don't make me do this, don't make me do this, I don't want to do this. But I know I have to do this. And I signed up, and it was a life-changing experience, and I became a founding board member of that organization. It was wonderful. But then these drug cocktails came in, people stopped dying at the rates they were dying. My business picked up again. It was like, okay, well, there's an experience. 15, 20 years later, I'm at a shamanic retreat for gay men. Some of you may or may not know that shamanism, particularly in some cultures, Native American culture, two spirited beings, the gay man, who has the male and female in one body. He becomes the enlightened healer of the tribe. He becomes the shaman. I went to take the shamanic workshop. I meet a Catholic priest who's a hospital chaplain. I call him on the Monday after the weekend. I say, you know, how was it getting back to work? He says, oh, it was a little rough, but I met so many beautiful people today. And I thought, remember that nightlight experience? That was so wonderful. It was wonderful to be around meaning instead of, what color do you think my kitchen will be? And will it be ready for my party? I called my sister, happens to be a lesbian. Her partner was studying to be a chaplain. She says, you don't have to be a minister to be a chaplain. Call UCLA. They're a teaching hospital. I said, yeah, right. I'm going to be a chaplain. I called UCLA, got the spiritual care director. I said, I'm an out gay man, I'm an activist, I'm not a Christian, I'm not religious, I don't really like religion, but I feel very drawn to this work. Is any of that a deal breaker? And she said, no. First step is fill out an application. The application took me all summer to fill out. First question, write a full account of your life, describe your family of origin, your current family relationships. What are the major events in your life that have made you who you are? 10 pages later, and I told the whole truth. I've been into some weird stuff, and I thought they're going to get this or they're not. And I got called in for an interview, and they accepted me. And so I'm there. But I don't have an MDiv. I'm not an ordained minister. I'm a very odd duck when it comes to chaplaincy. But there's no short way to tell that story, but that's how it got there. And so that's where now, when I could start with this man, I thought my life was over. And I thought God had... I mean, it was a spiritual crisis. And now that's the moment in time that absolutely made this possible. Well, now I feel like at 53, I finally found the thing I was put on the earth to do, and it took every single step circuitously along the way to get me here to be able to do this thing. I make a dollar and a half. I don't make any money, but I mean, it's like I go to sleep at night, and I feel like my life makes a difference. And so to not judge your circumstances where you are is a skill, and it's a gift to be able to do that and just say, this is how it is. This is how it is right now. I got cancer. I'm dying. Okay, so what? Next. What can I do with this reality?